I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk's poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia in the Arts Cafe of the Kelly Writers House by Jessica Lowenthal, poet, teacher, critic, and director of this very same Kelly Writers House and author of As If in Turning, and by Julia Block, veteran of Bay Area independent and progressive publishing at Tacoon, Curve, Wiretap, and other venues, a widely published poet, author of Post-Psychiatric Sonnets, and whose letters to Kelly Clarkson I highly recommend. And by Elizabeth Willis, coming to us today from Massachusetts, by way in the long run of Wisconsin, whose recent book of poems, Meteoric Flowers, was published by Wesleyan in 2006, winner of tons of prizes and grants, and whose other books include Turneresque, The Human Abstract, and Second Law. Welcome all three of you to Poem Talk. Thanks for coming from Massachusetts, Liz, for this. Welcome back to Philadelphia and to the Writers' House. And thanks, Liz, for telling me earlier that you're a fan of Poem Talk.
It's a great show.
Thank you. Our poem today is Erica Hunt's The Voice of No. It was collected in Hunt's book Arcade, published in 1996 by Kelsey Street Press. And each poem is accompanied by a reproduction of a woodcut by Allison Saar. Our recording of the poem comes from a June 2005 reading on the radio show Close Listening. So here now is Erica Hunt reading The Voice of No.
The voice of no. I have that voice. No need to be contrary. I put on a face. No use for muscle. The workers stand online for hours. No need to read 24 hours of the shopping channel. No fire. We have the illusion of doing what we want. Is that any way to talk with your tongue pressed against glass? The TV set is barking this Sunday morning, off when we acquire an instant memory and round language where the ends justify the ends. We rummage among the many unplugged connections looking for that darn fraction of a percent of the landscape you say it is possible to live in. Who will miss it when we divide up the sun, devour the young rather than give up our good seats? The postcards are bought out. The LP is skipping. And anyway, rescue is sure to be slow. In place of a raft, we paddle ladders past the litter of drifting bodies.
Jessica, what is all the no going on at the beginning of this poem? No need to become, no use for muscle. It seems, there's so many no's here that it seems for a moment at least that this, the poem, is the voice of no, as opposed to a voice that's opposed to the voice of no. What do you think?
I think on first reading, maybe, but those initial no's to me are an expression of disaffection, the disenfranchised. It's this horrible litany of lack of desire. It's boredom. It's complacency. It's a great list of horrible no's. I don't think that's the voice of no of the title.
When, Julia, Liz, when does it turn from all those no's to something else? When do you begin to, or when do you begin to realize that this is not the voice of no, that this is standing against the voice of no? Julia?
Well, one of the things I love about Erica Hunt is actually the way she reads, and I notice how her voice changes really suddenly after this list of no's, and it gets very performative, and I hear that kind of mom voice talking. I know she is a parent as well as a teacher and an activist. So I love how the poem turns there after this list. But I think the no is in the rest of the poem also, even though I don't think it ever comes back as a word.
No need to be contrary. I put on a face. No use for muscle. The workers stand online for hours. No need to read 24 hours of the shopping channel. No fire. We have the illusion of doing what we want. Is that any way to talk with your tongue pressed against glass?
But wait a minute, when she becomes maternal there in that second stanza, is that any way to talk with your tongue pressed? that's a maternal no. That's a trivial domestic no. I don't mean to say trivial, but it's trivial compared to the big geopolitical no's that are out there. So she is the voice of no there. The mom saying, "What are you doing? Putting your tongue next to the TV?" Liz, can you help us out of this mess?
A couple of things. I think actually the voice of no, to my mind, I mean the poem, The Voice of No, isn't really against the notion of refusal or of saying no. And actually I hear it as much as a child's voice, as a parent's voice. And I think even in the process of language acquisition, actually we know how to refuse things before we even know how to say what we want. Mm-hmm. And I think that it kind of moves between, you know, both the power of refusal and the kind of abjection on the other side of that.
Wow. This notion that, Julia, you were going to say
if
something,
I could jump
please.
In, yes. I like what you say, especially given the title, right? Because I think the title is both the voice of no, but also about voicing no, how to say no.
Yeah, well, there is that period. I'm a parent, and I know, I remember this well. There's a period, I can't remember when it happens, maybe in it's the terrible twos, I think, where no is not I don't want to do that mostly, but it's a I don't want to do whatever it is you want me to do. So it's an identity forming no.
Yeah, and actually I think that relates to the larger political content of the poem as
well.
Yeah,
I wanted you to go ahead.
As we as citizens are infantilized by the sort of demands for normativity from media, from the 24-hour shopping channel, et cetera.
For me, actually, the voice of no that emerges from this poem is my necessary response if I recognize that this is talking about the 24-hour channel, that if these are my options, no, thank you. And that's not necessarily in the poem. I have to come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
So just say no, or I prefer not to, all these sort of classic, in the former case, silly instances of refusal, the individual saying, no, this is not an option that I'm willing to accept. But I'm interested in Liz's idea of the great, I guess, romantic analogy, romantic capital R analogy. The child, the development of the child is as the development of the individual with respect to the state or with respect to the community. I mean, I have more to say about that, but you came all the way from Massachusetts. Why don't you tell us?
Well, I'm thinking, you know, even within the frame of economics, and that's why I think even in that first stanza, I hear the no as kind of moving between various kind of positions of subjectivity. When it says no need, no use for muscle, that's the voice of economics. The workers stand on line for hours. We're talking about a line of day workers who are lined up at, say, Home Depot or whatever, and there's no use for their labor. So that's kind of an abstract voice from outside, I think.
And of course, one of us needed to say, and I might as well be the one to throw it in there, the little biographical fact that we know as fans of Erica Hunt that she is the executive director of the 21st Century Foundation, which is very, very unique in that it helps direct funding to build and rebuild Black communities, and many of its donors, its big donors, are African Americans. And Erica deals all the time with these very problems. So if you do that biographical imposition, which I'm certainly happy to do, this is not that close a reading, you begin to see here is a citizen, a mother, and the director of a foundation that is to go to places such as the one that's been flooded at the end. This is pre-Katrina, you can be sure, but this is something that the 21st Century Foundation has been doing for years, to go to places like that that have been devastated by nature and to look at the things that are not nature that prevent these places from recovering. Julia?
And one of the really important things that the 21st Century Foundation does is support not just individuals, but also organizations. And Erica Hunt has written widely about the role of community in sort of African-American politics and civil rights. And one of the interesting things that the 21st Century Foundation did after Katrina was put pressure on the Red Cross to support not just individuals, but reach out to organizations and churches and community centers. And I think there's a lot in this poem about community.
Can you take us to that by word or phrase so we can move I guess you're talking about the second half.
Yeah, I look at the end of the second stanza. We rummage among the many unplugged connections, and then we get a stanza break.
Sure does
then,
sound like a Foundation director talking,
right,
doesn't it?
Right, and it's the TV. It's the unplugged TV. It's the lack of kind of the inadequate connectivity of TV. But I think it's also lack of community connection. And then we get looking for that darn, which is, of course, kind of a, I don't want to say curse word necessarily, but it's also mending. It's also about suturing something together.
We rummage among the many unplugged connections looking for that darn fraction of a percent of the landscape you say it is possible to live in.
Would anybody like to talk about the fraction of the percent of the landscape that someone says it's possible to live on?
I would. There's a sense that this we is buffeted about, that this we has no control over where it should live. It's a powerless we at that point.
Well, the you and the we are confused here. I mean, you at first, this is the fraction of a percentage of the landscape you say it's impossible to live in. Presumably that you is the naysayer, the large social leaderly naysayer. But then we get we divide up.
Well, I think Liz? That's a place where the speaker in making that a we and being part of that and not having it not be a they really implicates herself as being part of a society that divides up the sun, that, you know, I mean, we can hear
and
that as
nuclear
threat, or actually in relation to the devouring of the young. I mean, we can go back to ancient mythology and have, you know, bring in Cronus and the connection between the sun and devouring the young.
It's certainly there, don't you think?
Yeah.
But so that she has a good seat. It's not just the bad guys who have the good seats. She has the good seat too, so.
It's indicting. We are included in this problem.
This is privilege.
And you hear
it's
that in her privilege. Reading too. She says, our good seats. She really puts emphasis on that word.
And then you get this, I'm tempted to say Ashbarian sentences, the next five lines. The postcards are bought out. The LP is skipping, and anyway, rescue is sure to be slow. I say Ashbarian because it's somewhat non sequiturish, but also because I'm thinking of his poem Hard Times, which says, it may even be the first line, trust me, the world is run on a shoestring. And then he proceeds to tell us about how dysfunctional everything is. For him, it's comic, though.
Yeah.
For her, perhaps not.
The postcards are bought out. The LP is skipping. And anyway, rescue is sure to be slow. In place of a raft, we paddle ladders past the litter of drifting bodies.
Does anybody want to say something about those lines?
Well, I think that's interesting. I wouldn't have thought of them as Ashbarian, but I think what you're picking up on is really the role of the spectator. I mean, in Ashbery, it's often a very wry kind of subject position, but here I think that we're really talking about a location that is being used by people with money. I mean, if you think of Katrina in New Orleans and, you know, the postcards being bought up and, you know, here's this tourist site that is now a site of disaster.
And a fraction of a percent of a landscape. I mean, if that's not New Orleans, what is? This is, of course, an anachronism because the poem was written in the 90s and published in 1996. But what is that flood at the end? Can anybody say what's going on here? Someone's in a raft, and either we paddle, period, or we paddle ladders, which is a very frightening Cyrilla. Mm. You don't want to paddle ladders.
It doesn't get you very far.
Past dead bodies.
They make very leaky boats.
Very leaky. So this is like insufficient. You're like, here's a ladder.
Yeah.
See if that'll help you. Not a life preserver, but a ladder. Or I may be misreading that.
Well, I think of this also in terms of the desire for cultural and social ascendancy and the kind of symbolic use of the ladder. Like, guess what? You're not going to be able to climb that ladder, but, you know, maybe you can paddle your way
through
the wreckage.
Ladder is a very interesting word there because it, as I'm just repeating what you said, it signifies in this kind of setting rising, getting ahead, and rising above a lower status. And of course, here now it's horizontal and it's an inadequate life preserver.
I'd also add for me that the ladder helps actually make sense of that postcard and the LP. If what part of what's being searched for is a history that makes sense, connections to the past. If TV is what gives us this short memory? Was that how it's put in the poem?
The TV set is barking this Sunday morning off. I love that idiom, barking off. Or maybe we're sort of wasting away the Sunday, so we're
finally
sort of,
we have the day off.
We have the day off, right, this Sunday morning off. Oh, you're probably right about that. When we acquire an instant memory, Jessica?
So instant memory, postcards, if that's the alternative to television, that's not much more useful. So the latter being flat is also, it's in addition to being about economic mobility or lack of it, it's also about no connection past, if that makes sense.
As she's beginning to read this poem in our recording for Charles Bernstein's Close Listening, she said, I have this voice. I guess she means sometimes this is my voice.
The voice of no. I have that voice.
Does that throw us off, Julia? What do you think? Or is that a key to interpreting this poem?
I don't know. Maybe I'm willfully misreading her remark, but I see it a couple different ways. I do see it as I have the voice of no, but I also see it as a kind of statement of the poet. Like, I have the voice of no. I've got this down as a kind of political statement. I mean, not that there's not a tremendous amount of ambiguity and anxiety in this poem in terms of its politics. But
I like that reading, of course, ultimately, but I'm troubled by it in connection with the first line, no need to be contrary, I put on a face. I read that as if there's quotation marks around no need to be contrary, and the I put on a face is a way of saying I said as I put on a face. And that's a condescending line to a child. It's a way of saying, whoa, this no isn't going to get you very far. I'm in charge, or we've got some things we have to do. But in the context of the social life, it's very condescending. This is something that others say to you. No need to be contrary. Don't be so political. Don't be so strident.
I read it another way, actually.
Please.
I read it as a kind of admission of complacency or guilt. When I put on a face, I absolve the need to be contrary. I give up my political agitation.
Can you connect what we've just been talking about to the flood at the end? I've been thinking about the way the poem ends with a natural disaster, but clearly the inadequate response to that natural disaster is not natural itself, so that the poem could be saying that the ultimate voice of no is not natural, that it is a human, a constructed, putting the severed connections back together kind of response, refusing the acquiescence to the natural as a way of sort of leveling people out or of destroying the lower class or whatever.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you you asked that question following up on the discussion of the first line, no need to be contrary, I put on a face, which is really about masking and camouflage and kind of composing oneself for a public world. And I think that if we think of the naming of disasters as natural or unnatural, then we get into the deeper politics of that initial statement. And though this was, I gather, written in the early 90s, I mean, the book came out in 95, 96.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the period of Reaganomics very well, and we're reaping the fruits of those economic policies. So, and that was clearly a lot of the story around Katrina. Yes, there was a natural disaster, but it was what it was, partly because of the policies that had preceded it.
Well, certainly the line which just kills me in this poem, rescue is sure to be slow. It's a way of saying the structure that's been set up might as well be natural, because nothing particularly is going to happen in response to this. Well, speaking of the 80s, at a lecture at the New School in 1988, Erica Hunt gave a talk called Notes Toward an Oppositional Poetics. It was part of a conference on the politics of form. And one of her many points in this lecture, which is on Pensound and is worth listening to, is that the first step toward the creation of an oppositional poetics was, quote, to get past negation.
Mm.
Now, almost 10 years later, she writes a poem called The Voice of No. So I don't know what to do with that. Do we say that this poem is a working out of, this is the getting past negation and now we can do the work? Or has she decided really that negation is the politics? What do you think, Liz? You're nodding.
Well, I think negation is part of the work. I have been reading recently, rereading Aimé Césaire's Notebook of a Return to the Native Land, and that's like this poem. It's a work in which negation is incredibly important and powerful, and has to do with remembering accurately a really violent past, and yet being able to, by facing it, move on to something more constructive.
So we've been talking a lot about content and flow, but not so much about the form of the poem on the page. Does anybody want to say something about form? What's it look like? What do we have here? Any rhymes?
No, 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 no.
There is one somewhere.
I know Erica Hunt has talked about using rhymes to establish patterns, but also to create weird juxtapositions and unsettle her readers. And I really noticed that at the very end with paddle and ladders, and also litter and drifting in the litter of drifting bodies. It's a very spooky image, and I think she uses rhyme really effectively there.
And if we divide up the sun, devour the young, I mean, she reads sun and young, and it's parallel too in its meaning.
Liz? Yeah. Well, also I was thinking about how the early part of the poem functions so dialogically. We have the poem is three stanzas. The first two, each of those lines break very easily into two parts. No need to be contrary, I put on a face. No use for muscle, the workers stand on line. You can also hear the no turn to on in the second half of those lines.
No need to be contrary, I put on a face. No use for muscle, the workers stand on line for hours. No need to read 24 hours of the shopping channel. No fire. We have the illusion of doing what we want.
Well, this is such a great and complicated poem, and for me, devastating. I mean, when I put the personal and the political together, I'm desolate. A rescue is sure to be slow, seems to me almost inevitable here. I'm depressed, but exhilarated by how great a poem it is.
This is kind of my favorite kind of political poetry. It's one that refuses complacency, puts you square in the middle of your own responsibility, but leaves us possibility for changing a broken world.
I'm thrilled with the idea in this poem that choice is important, that desire is important, and when I don't have choice and desire, no is an appropriate response.
Yeah, and I think about the way that the poem deals with bodies in such a complex way as subjects and ultimately as objects in the end.
Before we get to the Gathering Paradise segment of our show, let me ask each of you to offer a brief final word on this poem, or maybe something more on what you get from it. Jessica, do you have something?
Yeah, I don't think you can be a complacent reader of this poem. It's challenging. It's not given in easy chunks. It's the opposite of the 24-hour shopping channel. And I think that's part of the politics here.
Great. Thank you. Julia?
I like looking at this poem in the context of another poem by Erica Hunt called Proof, in which she writes about the proof that we live in a broken world. I think about the oppositional politics of this poem as confronting that broken world.
Thank you. Liz?
I'm also interested in the time signatures within the piece. Even that LP that's skipping, I mean, we hear it as a signature that the party's over and somebody's inattentive to the score that we're supposed to be listening to. But also, boy, it's a generational thing. It's a trace of the analog world.
Nice. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands, gather a little something really poetically good to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. So, Jessica, can you gather a little paradise for us today?
Yes, in honor of Julia and Liz, I thought I'd mention a new book called Women Poets on Mentorship, because they have a mentoring relationship. This is a book of essays that includes work by Jennifer Moxley on Susan Howe, Miranda Field on Fanny Howe, and others.
Thank you. Julia?
A site that is probably old to others but new to me, weirddearmedia.com. Travis Nichols in Seattle, his site, which has a hotline for uploading your own voice clips of poetry. It's an incredible mixed media poetry site, weirddearmedia.com.
That's great. Thank you. Liz?
I would shout out to Essay Press in Ohio, edited by Catherine Taylor, Stephen Cope, and Eula Biss. Very interesting new press doing cross-genre work.
Well, that's all the weird deers we have time for in Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writers' House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writers' House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my colleagues Jessica Lowenthal, Julia Block, Elizabeth Willis, and to Poem Talk's director and editor, Steve McLaughlin, and a warm welcome to the Poem Talk team, to James Lemaire, and finally a shout out to Erica Hunt herself for her great work with the 21st Century Foundation, 21cf.org. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.